So welcome to this fourth lecture, fourth and final lecture, on C.G. Jung and the Red Book. I've titled this lecture, The Hermeneutics of Vision. Liber Novus, the Red Book, is Jung's documentation of an extraordinary event. Experience, journey, choose the word you wish. It is a unique modern document, a book unlike any other, entirely beyond category or comparison. As such, it's a difficult book to approach, to read, to comprehend, or to summarize. It fractures our expectations. It speaks with voices beyond our common ken. To paraphrase a comment I've heard made several times, the physical book, holding it, touching it, even seems inexplicably magical. And this absent any credence in magic. Liber Novus is, in simplest description, the journal of Jung's journey to the other pole of reality, the unknown realm of the psyche. I've used this figuration of a journey throughout these lectures to describe the event. It seems appropriate in part because Jung himself found it an apt metaphor for what he had done. By turning off the critical extroversion of consciousness, by turning inward, observing the psyche, letting things happen, Jung found passage into a visionary reality that he recognized to be a natural, if forgotten, companion of consciousness. In his journey, Jung experienced his empirical man entering a greater dimension, what he described as a divine realm, the realm of the greater self. In this union with that greater self, he rediscovered the God image. He poignantly summarizes his experience in the final section of Liber Novus, recorded in September of 1915, 2 years into this journey of discovery. And I quote, "Through uniting with the self, we reach the God. I must say this, not with reference to the opinions of the ancients, or this or that authority, but because I have experienced it. It has happened thus to me. And it certainly happened in a way that I neither expected nor wished for. The experience of the God in this form was unexpected and unwanted. I wish I could say it was a deception, and only too willingly would I disown this experience. But I cannot deny that it has seized me beyond all measure and steadily goes on working in me. So, if it is a deception, then deception is my God. Moreover, the God is the deception. And if this were already the greatest bitterness that could happen to me, I would have to confess to this experience and recognize the God in it. No insight or objection is so strong that it could surpass the strength of this experience. And even if the God had revealed himself in a meaningless abomination, I could only avow that I have experienced God in it." I even know that it is not too difficult to cite a theory that would sufficiently explain my experience and join it to the already known. I could furnish this theory myself and be satisfied in intellectual terms. And yet this theory would be unable to remove even the smallest part of the knowledge that I have experienced, the God. I recognize the God by the unshakableness of the experience. I cannot help but recognize him by the experience. I do not want to believe it. I do not need to believe it, nor could I believe it. End quote. At this point, belief, theory, were gone. Jung knew something now, something he could never recant or deny. Regardless of what use or value the spirit of this time attributes to Liber Novus, the Red Book, we now have an historical record in hand. Speaking from a rational, critical perspective, in light of current documentation, it seems impossible to deny that Jung did take this journey. He walked through the doorway of imagination into what he understood to be the depths of the psyche. He passed the threshold understanding he was entering upon an unprecedented, difficult, and dangerous self-experimentation. As a physician and scientist dedicated to the healing of the soul, he determined at the beginning of this experiment that he would keep a careful diary of the events. At the beginning, he had no sense of the end. He did not know where it would lead. On December 12th of 1913, in the threshold vision of this journey, and I use that word, vision, because that is precisely the word that Jung used to describe this event. In that threshold vision, the prophet Elijah tells Jung, seek untiringly, and above all, write exactly what you see. Seek untiringly and write exactly what you see. And he did. In his 6 black notebooks, the ledger and journal of his adventure, Jung presents Liber Novus as the record of his journey, what he heard, what he saw, and in reflection, the power of the experience upon him. Now, as you hold the record in hand, and as you read Liber Novus, as you attempt to understand what Jung is doing, keep forward in consciousness this important fact. The event recorded in Liber Novus is the foundation, the unshakable bedrock of all of Jung's science, all of his later writings. Here I give the affirmation of Dr. Sonu Shamdasani, the foremost scholar of Jung's history and psychological work. But much more importantly, this also is Jung's affirmation. If you do not understand this book, if you do not carefully consider this book. You cannot come to any balanced comprehension of Jung, his life, and his work. A friend in New York City, who is a very literate critic, after listening to the first three lectures in this series, addressed me a letter with several questions. Questions that were bothering her, questions that she felt were left unanswered by the lectures. And I thought tonight that I should address those questions. They are intelligent, forthright questions, common and important questions. She wrote, "What are we to make of this remarkable story of Jung and his Red Book? Was Jung sane or insane when he had these visions? Is Jung a mystic in the sense that we have known mystics throughout human history? An artist crafting legendary literature built on unseen truths about human existence? A great scientist telling us something new about the capabilities of our actual inner consciousness? So what about Jung himself? And what about the content of his visions? Is there some objective, factual truth in it that we must accept as such? Does it apply to others, or was it just for himself?" These questions I was probing with the first three lectures in this series. Apparently, I stimulated the questions, but apparently, I did not adequately answer them. So let me here attempt to answer each of those questions. First, what are we to make of this remarkable story of Jung and his Red Book? My answer is, make of it what you will. That is your problem. That's the problem each of you face. I can share some perspectives from my own understanding, but judgment is yours. As Jung was told in the very beginning of his journey, and he recorded these words in his Black Book diary, quote, "Speak and write for those who want to listen and read. Speak and write for those who want to listen and read." Unquote. If you are inclined to listen and read, then before attempting to make anything of it or draw any conclusion from it, give it your careful attention. These lectures are only meant as a tool of introduction and orientation to that personal reading. And to that non-answer, I add another perspective for your consideration. What we have here is not only a remarkable story. To repeat the phrasing of the question, what is truly remarkable is that it is both a remarkable story and a remarkable history. In Jung, story and history cross. He awakened the mythopoetic imagination. He walked into the imaginal, the story, and found it to be completely real. There is an essential duality in his perspective. In him, history and story touch and wed. Wherever one stands in the spectrum of interest, whether you have just recently heard of Jung or spent decades reading and considering his work. The difficulty in getting Jung, hearing his voice, understanding his perspective, is inevitably the same. Jung said it himself, referring late in life to the misunderstanding he perpetually met. Quote, "What most people overlook or seem unable to understand is the fact that I regard the psyche as real. I regard the psyche as real." Jung understood the inner world, the world of the psyche, to be as infinite and real as the outer world of our conscious perception. As I read last week from the introductory declaration of Liber Novus, quote, "This inner world is truly infinite, in no way poorer than the outer one. Man lives in two worlds." End quote. The inner, the psychic reality, was one half of the whole human. This forgotten half of ourselves, this second world, was source of all our symbols, religions, and myths. From it came our God images. Our great art, in sum, our humanity. This was the source of the human story. Our history is the psyche's story. It is the imaginal that makes story. Story is our history. Consider those words. History and story. Her story, the soul's story, are wed. The imaginal, the vision, is doorway to this forgotten human dimension. The dimension of our human story. Unseen, unconsidered, disclaimed as madness, this dark half of our humanity haunts us. Our history becomes a hollow, meaningless madness. And we, in the immense imbalance of our hubris of consciousness, are rent and tortured and left stark raving mad. And so to the second question. Was Jung sane or insane when he had these visions? Well, that depends on one's definition of sane and insane. Where the borderland between the two lies depends on where in the muck you scratch a boundary line. Jung understood he was melding sense and nonsense. He was bringing sane into insane. And at the very beginning of his journey, of his task, of his event, of his experience, he had to ask himself this very question. Is this madness? Is this madness? At the beginning of the Red Book, the spirit of this times, which we might understand as the rational, conscious perspective, The spirit of this times confronts Jung. And I quote again from Liber Novus. But the spirit of this times stepped up to me and laid before me huge volumes which contained all my knowledge. Their pages were made of ore, and a steel stylus had engraved inexorable words in them. And he pointed to these inexorable words and spoke to me and said, "What you speak, this is madness." The spirit of the depths responded in you. What you speak is. What you speak is. To summarize Jung's repeated declarations, the inner world is. Man lives in two worlds. The inner world is as infinite in extent as our conscious perception of outer physical reality. Jung explained, reading again from Memories, Dreams, Reflections, "It is, of course, ironic that I, as psychiatrist, should at almost every step of my experiment have run into the same psychic material, which is the stuff of psychosis and is found in the insane. This is the fund of unconscious images, which fatally confuse the mental patient. But it is also the matrix of a mythopoetic imagination, which has vanished from our rational age. Unpopular, ambiguous, and dangerous. It is a voyage of discovery to the other pole of the world." The question used the word vision. Was Jung insane when he had these visions? So let me here also comment on my repeated use of the word vision in these lectures. Jung described the events recorded in Liber Novus variably as imaginations, as visions, and as fantasies. He stated in later works that the word fantasy suffered from inferior connotations in modern language, connotations that entirely failed to grasp the scope or depth of his experience, of this imaginal experience. But linguistically, Jung faced a conundrum. He faced the conundrum that our modern Western languages had no words with a scope of meaning that captured his experience. Modern men had no vital knowledge of the experience. He had known. And thus our language retained no vital living word for it. Here, the word must point to the experience, not concept, not theory. Experience. The word vision, which Jung used frequently, seems the best of modern words to point at Jung's experience. In years after the Red Book events, Jung privately recorded several other visions, and he called them just that. Visions. Not fantasies, not imaginations. Visions. Although a few critics have called this period of Jung's life a psychosis or madness, it clearly was not. nor should it be thought of as a creative illness. Jung experienced it as a profound healing. The historical record of the period documents that during the events recorded in Liber Novus, a period lasting intensely for about 5 or so years, Jung continued to function in a completely normal fashion in his daily, outward, professional, and family activities. And I summarize some of this in the first lecture. As Jung often pointed out, the terms madness, insanity, psychosis, illness, together reflect the intense bias of our age against the psyche, the psychic, the inner, the vision, the great otherness behind consciousness. We name it with malignant names, and then apotropaically hide our face from it. But Jung turned into it, looked it in the eyes, and let it speak. Thus, he discovered a mystery of wholeness, a mystery of human transformation. He found a holy wedding, a mystery of conjunction that healed the great wound of our age, the great wound of humanity. As clinical investigator, empiricist, physician, he made an observation based on his investigations. Until we recognize this forgotten companion, we are wounded. Knowing, meeting the forgotten self, the dark brother and sister, our other, this experience made us holy and fully human. This was what Jung called individuation, becoming whole. It was the healing of mankind's wound. And as physician, Jung had dedicated his life to this task of healing. So I'll dedicate the rest of this lecture to answering the remaining part of that series of entwined questions. The next large part of that question was this. Is Jung a mystic in the sense that we have known mystics throughout human history? An artist crafting famous literature built on unseen truths about human existence? Or a great scientist telling us something new about the capabilities of our actual inner consciousness? The question asks for an interpretation of what Jung is. Jung had an unusual experience. The experience apparently formed and transformed him. How do we interpret this man and this experience? To use a more complicated word, what is our hermeneutic method to the man? Do we interpret what he is, his creative human activity, in terms of mysticism or art and literature or science? My quick answer is put him in all those categories. But in so doing, realize that you have just created a unique new category and radically opened the scope of possible definition. The only way to answer this question more thoroughly is to carefully look at how Jung interpreted his experience. And to do this with Liber Novus in hand, we have a pretty good record of Jung's interpretive approach. Now, what follows, I'm probably going to confuse and maybe lose some of you. We're about to head down a difficult path. But then, Jung spent a lifetime trying to explain his experience and found the task difficult. So, in difficulties, I suppose we have good company. I use this word, hermeneutic. It's interpreted in dictionary form as the art or science of interpretation, especially of scripture. And it's commonly distinguished from exegesis or practical exposition. But to understand the word, I think perhaps it's better to move to its mythological root, hermeneutic. It's an ancient word, and its etymology probably starts with the name of Hermes. Hermes was the messenger of the gods. He was the great ancient translator. And his duty, his task, well, to move from light to dark, from the realm of the gods to the realm of man, to interpret the words of one to the other. The hermeneutic task, the interpretive task, takes a great deal from this image of Hermes, he who brings meaning, he who translates between two perspectives, two languages, two tongues, perhaps even between the divine and the human. And this is why the term hermeneutic so often is associated with the interpretation of scripture. Liber Novus demanded a hermeneutic process that was multi-layered in complexity. Liber Novus demanded an interpretation from Jung. First off, from the very beginning of his journey in 1913, Jung struggled with this primary hermeneutic. The task of translating his imaginative encounter, his visions, into words. In a sense, this is the core of the historical meaning of hermeneutics, the hermetic task. The translators of Liber Novus, John Peck, Mark Kibbers, and Sonu Shambhasani, comment on their own hermeneutic task in translating Liber Novus. Quote, "At the outset of Liber Novus, Jung experiences a crisis of language. The spirit of the depths, who immediately challenges Jung's use of language, along with the spirit of the time, informs Jung that on the terrain of his soul, his achieved language will no longer serve." End quote. The didactic, discursive forms of his well-honed scientific jargon are of no further use to Jung in this journey. Jung confronts the challenge before him in his introduction to Liber Novus, and he makes this petition to the reader for understanding. Quote, "My speech is imperfect, not because I want to shine with words, but out of the impossibility of finding those words. I speak in images. With nothing else can I express the words from the depths." End quote. So The first hermeneutic task is bringing the experience, an extraordinary, visionary, imaginative event, into language, finding for it form in word image. Near the end of life, Jung spoke of these visions as the fiery magma out of which the stone that had to be worked was crystallized. The fiery magma out of which the stone that had to be worked was crystallized. From the fiery magma of his visionary experience, a stone had to be crystallized. This was the challenge of the primary hermeneutic, the initial work of translation, interpretation, and formation of the visions into word. One might image this primary interpretive enterprise on a vertical axis. Jung standing in the center of the axis, melding above and below, inner and outer, bringing the vision, the imaginative experience, into a symbolic language of word image. After the draft text, the word image was composed. The primary hermeneutic exercise was augmented by scribing the words into an archaic, hieratic, calligraphic script, and adding graphic images, paintings. Thus, the verbal stratum of Jung's vision was extended into a complex layering of form. Word and image, all together inherently symbolic of the otherness, the fiery magma of his experience. The result is Liber Novus. Jung's precious red book. In the history of creative imagination, this sort of activity is not unknown. In the prophetic engraved books of William Blake, and in the poetic visions of Goethe and Dante, to give an abbreviated list, one senses a similar task completed, a crystallizing of form from the fiery magma of vision. Put in context of great imaginative works of art, Jung's Liber Novus, his primary translation of the vision, is not entirely unique. The scope and content of the vision is certainly unique, but that an imaginative vision led to visual and verbal creation is not. Speaking of such imaginative art across the ages, and tacitly including his own unknown work, Jung writes in 1930 that great imaginative art, quote, draws its strength from the life of mankind, and we completely miss its meaning if we try to derive it from personal factors. And by personal factors, he means devoid of the penetration of the inner psychic dimension. He continues, whenever the collective unconscious becomes a living experience and is brought to bear upon the conscious outlook of an age, this event is a creative act which is of importance for a whole epoch. A work of art is produced that may truthfully be called a message to generations of men. A message to generations of men. I'm quite certain that the cryptic inner text here refers also to Liber Novus. He continues, every period has its bias, its particular prejudice, its psychic malaise. An epic is like an individual. It has its own limitations of conscious outlook, and therefore requires a compensatory adjustment. This is effected by the collective unconscious when a poet or seer lends expression to the unspoken desire of the times and shows the way by word or deed to its fulfillment. End quote. From here we move on to what was unique in Jung's hermeneutic. This is what I would call the second layer, the second stratum of his hermeneutic task. You'll remember that at the beginning of this enterprise, a female voice came to Jung, declaring that what he was doing was art. He, however, could not accept it. He sensed he was doing something else. Jung perceived his vocation was not simply to be a conduit of vision, its mystical channeler or artistic hand. Another additional task had fallen to him. As a physician, he had undertaken an experiment, an exploration. What happened on the journey was indeed extraordinary. It was unexpected, creative, artistic, imaginative, and more. In that experience, Jung penetrated to a profound depth. He felt he had walked the road of seers and prophets. He had experienced the rebirth of the God image. As he said, "It has happened thus in me. I wish I could say it was a deception, and only too willingly would I disown this experience, but I cannot deny it. It has seized me beyond all measure and steadily goes on working in me. I do not want to believe it. I do not need to believe it. I could not believe it." Belief for Jung was no longer the issue. He knew something. He had seen a reality. He held a crystallized stone in his hand. Having completed the first task, the crystallization of the stone, the first stage of the hermeneutic enterprise, he faced the next stage. The stone had been crystallized. Now it had to be worked. And if in these terms you sense an alchemical metaphor, it's because it's there. Jung had discovered the depth and vitality of the mythopoetic imagination. The doorway opened to him, the forgotten other pole of human nature, the great mystery behind human consciousness. Working the stone involved translating this experience into generic human terms. Working the stone, translating the experience into human terms, generic human terms. He had now to elucidate the process, explain how to enter the journey, give aid with maps of the terrain, and thereby disclose what he had learned from his investigation. Think of this as a horizontal axis, reflecting the event against the mirror of human experience. Here Jung's hermeneutic enterprise becomes unique, extraordinary, unprecedented. Jung distinguishes himself from the pattern of the great artistic vision in this project of understanding vision itself. Understanding the imaginal. Mapping its terrain, translating the event into a secondary interpretive layer. And this without ever revealing the event itself, without ever revealing the initial event he had suffered. Remember the Red Book and the events around it were not publicly disclosed. So part of the question asked above was, does the content of Jung's visions, apply to others, or was it just simply for himself? The answer here is, Jung clearly felt his experience had generic import. He was not attempting to interpret the events in terms of his personal psychology. Jung understood his encounter with the spirit of the depths was transpersonal in its nature. At the end of his life, he said, and I quote, "When I look back upon it all today and consider what happened to me during the period of my work on the fantasies, it seems as though a message had come to me with overwhelming force. There were things in the images which concerned not only myself, but many others. It was then that I ceased to belong to myself alone, ceased to have the right to do so. From then on, my life belonged to the generality." His experience brought certainty about the reality of an objective, collective level of the psyche. It was not a matter of belief. He had known it. His experience and this knowledge belonged to the generality. Jung encountered a psychic fact that, in his opinion, was source to the development of religious myth and symbol and great imaginative art throughout our human history. To translate the visions into generic human principles, to work the stone he had crystallized, he now needed to develop a descriptive vocabulary, a language adequate to the many symbolic and imaginative tongues with which this experience had spoken itself within him and within history. Jung termed this his constructive or hermeneutic method. As he stated in 1916, speaking of the symbolic statements encountered in a confrontation with this inner psychic dimension of reality, and in 1916, speaking specifically about what he was undergoing in his journey, he says, "The symbol is not a sign that disguises something generally known. The symbol's meaning resides in the fact that it is an attempt to elucidate something that is still entirely unknown or still in the process of formation. Something trying to crystallize, something trying to come to consciousness," I would add. Continuing with Jung's words, "The essence of hermeneutics, an art widely practiced in former times, consists in adding further analogies to the one already supplied by the symbol." End quote. So, for example, he applied this constructive or hermeneutic method to his encounter with the prophet Elijah and Salome. Here was a meaning unknown, or still in the process of formation. Why had these two figures come to him? What meaning was being conveyed by the psyche in their visionary apparition, in their words to him, of which we spoke in our last lecture? Jung reflected on the history of similar stories, comparative images that had emerged from the imaginative realm. And by this analogic process, attempted to elucidate the meaning of his vision, meanings that were unknown or in the process of formation. So he looked at Dante's experience of Virgil and Beatrice, the origins of Christianity and the related mythic images of Logos and Sophia, the story of Simon Magus and his bride of wisdom, Helena, Goethe's vision of Faust and Helen and Gretchen. From these, Jung got a sense of what the psyche was repeatedly trying to express with images of the wise old man and the maiden, the prophet and his daughter, sister, bride. You'll find these specific symbolic motifs repeatedly addressed in Jung's later writings. This was his great threshold vision, and he worked its meanings frequently throughout the rest of his life. Through this hermeneutic amplification, he sensed the universality of the images that had crystallized in his stone. They had what he would soon come to call a common archetypal character. I say, would soon come to call. Here, you see, is the task of this secondary hermeneutic. What is the interpretive vocabulary for experience of the psyche? How does one speak about the events of such journey to the other pole of reality? The travels of a wayfaring man who breaches the walls that constrict vision and thence discovers the immensity, the infinity of the inner world. How does one speak of the form and motive of the purely spontaneous intrusions of this deeper reality into daylight consciousness? The core vocabulary of Jung's psychology, words like archetype, active imagination, collective unconscious, anima, animus, persona, individuation. All these words were first spoken descriptively by Jung between the years 1916 and 1918. In the development of this second axis of his hermeneutic project, a project to find an interpretive vocabulary for the experiences that had begun in 1913. He subsequently used this new interpretive vocabulary and the comparative hermeneutic method of analogic amplification to help other people meaningfully translate their own experience of the psyche. This was a central element of Jung's project, of Jung's science. But there is a third crucial dimension to Jung's hermeneutic, his multi-layered, lifelong translation of the fiery magma, of the visions, of the event that produced Liber Novus. This third layer began taking form around 1928. And once it had developed, once he had seen the potential of this third method of interpreting his vision and conveying it to his own age, his attentions for the remaining 30 years of his life were focused on it. Remember, at the beginning of the process of writing his diaries, of recording in his journal, in his black books, the events that transpired, the visions, the imaginative experience. At the beginning, he had no sense of the end. He did not know where it led. After the first explosion of this material, between December of 1913 and spring of 1914, he turned himself to producing a draft manuscript of what would become Liber Novus. At first, he began transcribing his visionary material from the draft compilation made from his diaries on pages of parchment. And then he commissioned a book, a beautifully bound red leather book. He commissioned the book to have 600 pages. Blank. He knew he was going to record his experience in the book. He ordered a book of 600 pages. In his draft material, his first draft, handwritten, of the material that would go into Liber Novus, amounted to about 1,200 written pages. And then a second layer of material developed in 1916 and 1917 that he transcribed into something like an additional 600 pages. Of this material, in various forms, at least 1,800 pages, he eventually only transcribed about two-thirds into the Red Book. Of this 600-page book, Jung filled 200 pages. And then that enterprise ended. The book is an unfinished book. Why did it end? Well, this has to do with that critical issue of the third hermeneutic enterprise. In 1928, Jung received the copy of a manuscript of a book called The Secret of the Golden Flower, a translation made by Richard Wilhelm of a Chinese Taoist text. At this point, Jung had been struggling with his project of translating the event into a science. He had gone through this first and second layer of his hermeneutic, but he knew that he could not reveal the Red Book. Although he considered it, certainly, he discussed it, and as Dr. Shamdasani outlines in the editorial notes to the Red Book, the project, well, the project seemed as if it needed publication. It was the hidden intertext, the Rosetta Stone, shall we say, to all that Jung was doing. But he could not reveal it. He knew it would not be understood. In 1928, when he received his copy of The Secret of the Golden Flower, to which he was asked to add a psychological commentary, he found the missing key, the key he had sought. You see, Jung's project, Jung's journey had a very specific nature. As I've tried to emphasize, this was an active process, an active imaginal process. Jung was willfully attempting to explore the psychic realm. And he went through the doorways deeply into that realm. He came back with knowledge of it. This is different than the spontaneous eruption of psychic material into consciousness, which happens to all of us, whether we know it or not, every day. Jung was asking himself if there had been anyone else in history who had done what he had done, Now, in the examples of great art and literature, he certainly saw evidence of an explosion of the collective unconscious, the deeper inner psyche, into consciousness. But were people striving after that entry, looking to it? Jung had been wholly moved by his experience, by the event, the journey. In submitting his ego to the spirit of the depths, he had undergone a transformation, an individuation. He had labored with the primary task of translating the visionary, imaginative experience to word image, words of symbolic and mythic form, the Red Book. From that primary work, he had moved to a second enterprise, the development of a descriptive psychological vocabulary and comparative analogic method. Think of this as a cross, a crossing. Understand that the vertical axis and the horizontal axis of this hermeneutic task intersected in Jung. He stood the conscious center of this crossing. He hung on that cross. And that gave him a very unique perspective. From that vantage point, he began to recognize that others had had similar experiences. He began to note that they too had actively stepped into the reality of the psyche, felt the spirit of the depths, and from that experience made their own attempts at crystallizing fiery magma and working the crystallized stone. Jung had recognized the sovereignty of the psyche and actively sought to penetrate this inner world. He addressed himself to it, and he had worked to find the pathway through it. So, from Jung's unusual visionary vantage point, he was forced to ask himself a question. Did other historical men and women turn to the psyche, as he had, and actively address, petition, explore it, and then crystallize from it, from that fiery furnace, a stone? The first place he had seen historical evidence of similar activity with similar results was in the remnants of ancient Gnostic Christianity, a tradition declared heretical by dogmatic formations of orthodoxy during the late 2nd and 3rd centuries, and violently suppressed once that dogmatic orthodoxy had acquired sufficient political power in the 4th century and thereafter. This was, of course, an obvious place for Jung to see it. His spirit guide and teacher in the journey, Philemon, had at the end of the Red Book announced himself as a Gnostic. Philemon spoke through Jung 7 sermons to the dead, and they are the summary revelation of the Red Book. They fill the last pages of Liber Novus. They are the only part of Liber Novus that Jung published, although privately, published in 1916, and distributed personally throughout his lifetime. These are echoes of an ancient Gnostic voice, and Jung knew that voice. He recognized it, and he studied it intensely during the entire period of his development of this second layer of his hermeneutic, shall we say, from 1920 through 1930. But Gnostic tradition was just too distant. The documentary evidence remaining had been corrupted, fragmented. And although every instinct and intuition told you the ancient Gnostics had been up to the same stuff he was, the historical evidence was too thin for him to build a scientific case. And then Wilhelm sent him The Secret of the Golden Flower. Now, what he found in the text was a Taoist alchemical process that he immediately identified as a very close analog of what he had been doing. And the end of that text, the goal of that process in the Secret of the Golden Flower, he also had experienced the same goal, the same end of the process, spontaneously had come to him in his own formation, creation of the mandala structure, which he identified with the wholeness of the self. This was a lightning bolt. He knew he could not reveal Liber Novus and use that as the paradigm text for explication of his psychology, although his psychology was indeed founded upon that bedrock. Now he saw a second path. Without using his own text, he found another tradition which offered him a way. And so he wrote his commentary on The Secret of the Golden Flower in 1928. And in that commentary, if you read it, you'll find that he speaks repeatedly of vision as a doorway to the inner realm. He's not speaking about dream. He's speaking about an active process of evoking, invoking, entering vision, entering the inner realm, working through the process of that journey towards a synthetic goal, a formation, a wholeness. Shortly thereafter, Jung came to understand that this Taoist text was indeed an alchemical text. And then he realized that this same process had been the core of a misunderstood Western meditative technique called alchemy, the foundation of the modern chemical science. I've used this figuration of a journey. As a result of Jung's journey, he had seen a terrain. He had a sense of what existed in the inner realm. He had a map. Now, he also had an ear, an understanding. When he heard the material presented in The Secret of the Golden Flower, he recognized it as something because he had known that something. The same thing happened as he approached alchemy. He came to understand what the old alchemists were about, what their meditative, imaginative process was working at, what their arcane vocabulary was pointing at, because he knew that terrain. He knew that journey. One might call this a hermeneutic, a vision. Only by the fact of his vision, of having known this thing, this place, this inner realm, was he able to see it elsewhere. His vision was the hermeneutic, interpretive tool. It was his key. Jung came to identify this tradition of vision in Western tradition. He maintained that alchemy itself was a metamorphosis, a recasting of the early Gnostic intuition. But he did something else as well here. Jung understood that for modern men and women to understand this hermeneutic, this interpretive enterprise, they needed what he had. They needed to experience this realm unseen, unknown, untouched. They could not possibly understand it. And here, the hermeneutic turns into a process, a transformative process, a psychological task. You'll remember that in 1922, Jung's soul came to him and said that you have the revelation. You must declare it. You must form the new religion. Did Jung form a new religion? Did he declare himself a prophet? No. He did something much more important. With every fiber of his will, with every power he possessed, he turned himself in the last 30 years of his life to explaining the reality of the inner, the psychic reality. He understood that if he could guide and direct others into this realm, they would find. They would find the source of the God images. They would know. One might call it a Gnostic process, because you see, this was not a dogma. Jung really had no theory. He had a process. He trusted the psyche. His attempt was to bring others into that experience. His interpretation rested upon the reality of vision. The reality of the experience of knowing. To amplify his psychological texts, to amplify his essays, to amplify his vocabulary, he turned to the traditions of this vision, of this hermeneutic of vision. And he understood an additional layer to this, that there were traditions which had existed to foster vision. There were traditions which knew that the only way the tradition could be understood was through the process of vision. The texts, the writings, the myths, the stories of these traditions had one sole purpose: to be an entryway, to be a doorway, to be a guide, to be a map to one's own entry into vision, into the inner realm, into a knowing, into a personal experience of the depths of the forgotten half of what we were. Depths which Jung described as a divine realm. So did he form a religion? No. What he did do is critique religion in the form of dogma, in the form of theory, religion in the form of psychology, religion in the form of science of our age, religion in the form of the spirit of this time, the spirit, the dogma, the teaching, the insistence, the belief of this time that there is no such inner reality, no such fact as the psyche. He had known it. He knew it was there. Just as in former times, there had been traditions directed, oriented towards the experience, towards opening a pathway into this realm, so he saw his psychology as such an effort, at its deepest root, at its truest center. It was not theology. It was not a dogma. It was a doorway. and a petition. In Jung's own time, and he died in 1961, the only way one became a Jungian analyst was by going through the analytic process oneself. And when could one then graduate from that process and become an analyst? There was no test. There were no essays that had to be written, books that had to be read. When one was ready, it's when one's own analyst said, "This person knows something. They have penetrated into the psyche. They have met the fact of this reality. And until that reality was met, until that fact was known, no one had the right to try to direct another in this realm." It was a personal transmission, shall we say, a personal initiation. And the result was a personal journey. Now that's changed. That's changed. Jung never thought that the Jung Institute, named after him against his will, that the institution of a psychology in his name had any future. There are many people around today who call themselves Jungians, analysts. Very few of them, have had the experience that Jung demanded before one entered that path as a director. Because of the absence of theory in Jungian psychology, because of the centrality of the vision itself, there have been accretions to Jungian psychology of various other systems, various other dogmas, various other ideas. It's become enmeshed in a much larger project. Call it archetypal psychology, if you will. It spreads outward. And increasingly, much to the pain of many who understood and now understand what Jung was about, much to the pain of such people, Jung is lost in it. We stand at a threshold. Finally, the stone, crystallized from the fiery magma and worked by Jung. The primary hermeneutic, the foundation piece of Jung's psychology, is revealed to us. I have spent 4 months reading both the Red Book and reading and rereading most of Jung's major works. I can tell you that it is almost impossible to grab a volume of Jung's work authored after 1916 and randomly open it and read 2 pages without finding Liber Novus, without finding that stone Jung crystallized. We're at a threshold of re-understanding Jung, meeting the man anew. But this time, you see, we meet him with his primary interpretive text by our side. As Dr. Shyam Dasani said in New York at the inaugural address on publication of the Red Book, "Now we can sit with Liber Novus open at one side and Jung's other writings at the other. And we can see how the ideas flow one from the other. And in that process, I assure you, you will find a great amplification, a deepening understanding, perhaps even an awe at what Jung did. The last question my friend asked me in that series of questions was a private question. She said, "It seems all these many years that you've idolized Jung. And I reflected upon that. I don't idolize Jung. It reminded me of a comment made by a prominent Jungian analyst with whom I had the opportunity to share a dinner. She was speaking of a mentor she had known by the name of Edward Ettinger, a man who had thought of Jung as a man for the ages. And she had referred to Ettinger and saying, well, his problem was is he never resolved his transference on Jung. Never resolved his transference. In the course of human history, there are extraordinary human events. There are moments that transform a culture, a society, that remold the human story. Jung referred to such things in that essay I read you on literature and psychology. Liber Novus constitutes such a moment, such a work. Jung, as a force, as a fact, constitutes such a human, such a man. This is not idealizing. This is recognizing. This is understanding. This is knowing. Carl Gustav Jung and his hermeneutic task, his task of bringing to this age, of interpreting to this age, of translating into the tongue of this age, the fact, the reality of vision. So thank you very much.